One thing I always ask my very serious question, I always ask my British interviews is, what tea do you drink and how do you drink it?
What tea?
Yeah.
Is it, so you're recording this, are you, right now?
I am.
Yeah.
Is it okay?
It's funny you should say that because, you know, I said I did some shopping on the way back and I bought some tea, right? I did, I bought some tea. Bought some tea from a supermarket called Asda.
Oh, yeah.
And Asda Gold, because I'm very, very fussy about my tea. Ah. And coming from the north of England, I like it strong. Mm-hmm. I always make it with, I've got my own way of making it. I put the milk in first with the tea bag. Mm. Not too much, because I can't stand milky tea. But just a little bit of milk. And then I put... This is enthralling, isn't it? I put some boiling water in, just half a cup, and leave it for about 4 to 5 minutes, and then boil the water again and fill it up, and squish the tea bag around, and I've got a nice full cup of tea now. So there you go.
That sounds definitely putting hair on chest type
that's
stuff.
That's right. Yeah.
I love it. I've got my Assam tea by my side. We're okay.
Very good. So it's I know the Americans drink. I lived out there for some time, and
right.
And not many people drink tea the way we do.
No, well, for a start, they don't know how to boil water. That's a real problem.
You're not going to say that on air, are you?
Oh, you bet. I always give it to them. You know, it's, you got to. Bring them up to certain standards, you know.
Yeah.
I've converted a few people. But right, now you said you came from, from Preston.
That's right, now, that's where I am now, yeah.
Oh, you are in there, okay.
Now, yeah, I'm back in Preston.
Oh, okay. Now, the thing I remember about Preston growing up was Tom Finney. He was the
that's
man.
Right. That's right, yeah. He's the local hero, really. And... I'm afraid, you know, in the last year or two, he's deteriorated a bit. He's got dementia.
Mm.
And I think he's in a home not actually very far from where I live. But, yeah, he's just one of the great soccer players, really, of all time, I suppose.
Yeah, I would put him up there.
Yeah. I only saw him play once. My father took me to watch him, I think, in about 1960. I think it may have been... could have been his last match for North End, I'm not sure. But but I've got pictures of him on the wall. I've got his book and... Yeah. It's, and there's a big statue outside the football ground here, so...
Oh, really? Oh, that's great.
Mm.
That's great. Well, I wish him well. It said that you got your first guitar when you were 12. Who gave it to you, and what was your inspiration for music?
Well, the inspiration factor really started, I think, with... Well, I was basically interested in music anyway. I suppose some of us, we just, you know, some things just have an effect on us. And music generally did that. My mother... she won the football pools.
Oh.
Now, that's something you don't get in America, is it? The football pools.
That's right. Was that Vernon's or Littlewood's?
Yeah, Vernon's, I think it was, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
And so she won the football pools. She won £50. And this was back in, I think, back in the 60s, but very, very early in the 60s. And she bought one of these gramophone players, you know, where you could stack the records up and they drop one by one.
Yeah.
And so I used to sit by the side of it for hours on end singing along with this music, and, you know, certain things would just send shivers down me. I was very affected by some of the music. But then the next thing really was my sister, who was 6 years older than me, and when she was 18, she went to university down in London. And she started bringing back these albums, Bob Dylan albums, for example, John Renbourn, Bert Jansch, And I was just blown away with the whole thing. You know, I was very much into the Beatles as well. And so I asked my mother if she'd buy me a guitar for Christmas, and I got this thing that was more like a sort of a ukulele. It just had four strings on it, this plastic effort. And after I'd been shown how to tune it up, within a day or two, there was this little booklet with all the songs in, like Home on the Range and everything. In a couple of days, I was singing them and playing them. And it went on from there. And the next to no time, she bought me a proper acoustic guitar. And that was it, really. I didn't really have to... there wasn't really any discipline for me involved in playing and practicing it, because I just enjoyed it so much.
Mm, interesting. What was your first real guitar? Do you remember? Do you have it, or do you remember what?
No, I don't. But the really, the first very very good guitar was when I was 16. Again, my mother, she put money aside for all of us. I had two sisters at the time, and she put away some money so that when we reached a certain age, we could, we could spend it on something that was sort of relevant to our career or whatever. And it was just £50, and seems to be an important figure. So she said, seeing that you're getting so good on a guitar, you can buy something decent. So I took 50 quid to Manchester and got myself a Gibson J45. And now that is still hanging on my wall in the studio where I'm sitting at the moment. So I got that for £50 at the age of 16. That was in 1967. And it's actually been stolen once and I got it back. So
wow.
Still have it.
That's quite something, to say the
least. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was talking about this earlier today with my mother and sister, because we were talking about, you remember the talent show New Faces?
Oh yes.
Back in the 70s. Well, my band Easy Street, we won New Faces. We won one of the shows there, and I was just remembering how we went out to celebrate after the show for a Chinese meal, walked out of the restaurant back to the truck, and all our equipment had been stolen. So that's when that acoustic guitar was stolen, and it got so much publicity in the Birmingham area that a police informer who heard some people talking about this equipment basically gave us the information of who had it. We just had to pay him a few quid, and we got it back. We probably paid 50 quid. That seems to be the figure of the day.
It'll get you anything, yeah.
That's right.
So from the heights to the depths you went on that day.
Yeah, it was a real roller coaster, yeah. Such is life.
Jumping into your band, obviously you learnt how to play the guitar and started gigging professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was up in around Preston.
Yes, it was originally. Because I was so young and I hadn't moved away by that time. But when I was about 17 or 18, I did move down to Derby. And I stayed there for maybe 10 months and played the clubs in that area. Mm. It was only about 1970 when I moved to London and joined up with Peter Marsh.
Mm. Oh, so it was a few years then before you even got to getting your first album?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Most of the time I was just playing folk clubs, I was a ragtime finger picker.
Listening to your music, you play a number of stringed instruments. What do you play, in fact?
Well, I play whatever I decide to for whichever project I'm working on at the time. It's not really... I would never consider myself a multi-instrumentalist because, I could pick up the banjo now and sing you a song, but I couldn't really play anything else on the banjo. So what I'll... from time to time, I'll think, oh, I need a ukulele song, so I'll write a song on ukulele. I'll write the piece for that instrument. But the rest of the time, I hardly ever pick them up. But on the albums, I play. I do play uke. I play five-string banjo. I quite enjoy five-string banjo, actually. Electric guitar and acoustic guitar and dobro, you know, steel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's probably about it, really.
Well, that's pretty good. Do you have a preference, you know, acoustic to electric?
Well, not so much a preference, but I think that I naturally gravitate just towards a steel-strung acoustic guitar more than anything else. That's what comes naturally to me. And so if, without, you know, without thinking about it, if I was going to reach for an instrument, that's the one I'd reach for. And I think because I spent more time on the acoustic guitar, you know, that's what I'm best at, really.
Right. So who did you listen to? What other musicians got you going at that time?
Well, back then, you know, we're talking about the state of broadcasting in this country back then. And, of course, it was like, you know, the BBC just had a monopoly. And generally, I suppose, you know, people, as far as popular music went, people would only listen to Radio 1. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whereas most people would be listening to all this kind of glam rock stuff and 70s stuff, Brit rock or whatever you want to call it, yeah. I would be listening to Steely Dan, I'd be listening to Little Feat, James Taylor. You know, that was the kind of music that inspired me through that period. And so I've always felt quite an affinity, you know, towards that, towards the American music, or that kind of American music, mm-hmm. Certainly that West Coast type of sound, you know.
Yeah, definitely. In your Easy Street albums, there was definitely, you know, you could there was a nice blend of, you know, British to American, you know, definitely like an Eagle sound, or had that nice blend. It was cool.
Well, that's right. That's right. What appealed to me so much about much of that music was the, you know, the level of playing and production. Everything seemed to be done so well, and it was so smooth and everything. Whereas, you know, British music, I met so many Americans that love British music for the opposite reasons, because it's kind of rough around the edges.
I love it. Yeah, there's something for everybody, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you moved down to, you made the big move down to London. That was fairly momentous for you. You decided it was time to go big time?
Well, it was a mixture of things, really. I mean, you know, if I was to tell the truth, it was a very turbulent period for me. Mm. And I hadn't been in London very long at all, and I mean, really, I got what amounts to a breakdown. You know, mm. I got panic attacks and depression, and it was a very, very tough time. So a lot of what happened, in a way, happened. It sort of happened before me. It was a bit like a film going on, and somehow we managed to get record deals and make albums and. And I'm not sure how I survived, but that's what happened. I mean, that's, you know, it was more traumatic, that period, for me, than exciting, I would say.
Mm. Interesting. So, yeah, I suppose being young helps get through
that
time.
Well, it does, in a way. At least you've got the energy to get through things, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But then you came up with, you know, Easy Street Band, that's when I first came across you. I saw you, I think it was on the Loudon Wainwright tour, I saw you with him. And you're great live, and I just loved your albums, and I you know, I've played them ever since, basically. You know, in pirate radio days and now, so it's always made a deep impression on me, that music.
That's good to know.
You say that was a bad time. I mean, you were touring, trying to promote your albums. It was that must have been quite a trip.
If you look at the actual things we were doing from the outside, it looked very exciting. It looked like, you know, because we had the touring, the recording, and from my point of view at that time, it's difficult. I suppose when you go through certain difficult periods in your life, you can tend to feel that you have absolutely no self-esteem whatsoever, and it's a complete contrast to maybe how it would have appeared from another person's perspective. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the very things that look glamorous are the very things that you don't feel you can live up to. And that was the struggle for me at that time. When I look back, you know, I'm quite proud of some of the things that we did, and certainly the third Polydor album that we recorded, because we actually recorded that in Los Angeles. Mm. With I don't know if you, maybe you've never heard that. That was just called Nickel and Marsh, and we recorded that with some of the people that I'd been listening to, like Lee Sklar, you know, and Victor Feldman, and the keyboard player from Little Feet, you know, Bill Payne. Huh. Some of my heroes. We did the entire album with these people, and that was a great time, and very exciting.
You made the break to LA, and what a switch. Was it? But it sounds like it was quite a creative time for you.
Was a creative time again, a little turbulent, but and Los Angeles, I got swept away by certain things, you know, and the lifestyle and everything. And I had a lot of friends there as well, you see. I played with Al Stewart, Al had moved out there and with the band, and they're all friends of mine. So I did some work on albums with Al Stewart and Shot in the Dark. That's what his band was called.
Oh, okay.
But of course, you know, after a while, it got quite difficult. It's a whole different way of. It's different. It's a different way of living in many ways musically. Whereas here, you know, you can do a gig in a club and then go a few miles down the road and do a gig in another club. Of course, in America, there's vast distances between places, venues, cities, you know. And I did struggle, you know, from that point of view. And so much of the way you approach music over there is from a business point of view, which really wasn't my forte, you know. So it wasn't all that long before I came back here. Hmm. I came back and just regrouped and got out playing more gigs and just trying to discover what it was I wanted to do, really, you know, because I'd forgotten.
Good point. And now, one thing, you know, in between bands, you've always produced your own music as well and kept on creating, you know, not within a band. I mean, do you prefer by yourself, or do you like being with other people?
It really depends on the project. You know, I spent 8 years with Steel Eye Span and left the band just last year. And that was a very exciting period for me, particularly, you know, the first few years of that. I like going into new projects, I think, when it comes to bands. As far as my own solo performances are concerned, I mean, that's just an ongoing thing. That's something that's always felt natural to me. I have actually a project that I'm very excited about at the moment, and it's something that's turned into a stage production, and we're going to have we're going to run it for 5 nights, 5 pilot shows in November, down in Essex, and it's called The Glass Chronicles, and this really is all, you know, it's all come from. You know, what I suppose you would call my concept album.
Okay.
Yeah, and bit by bit I recorded this concept album called The Glass Chronicles. I started back in the 90s. It took me about 10 years to record. and never really knew what to do about it. And very recently, I found someone who wanted to put money into it and invest in the show. And now it's becoming a stage production.
Oh, congratulations! That's great.
Thank you.
Where's it going to be playing?
It's playing at a place called the High Barn in Great Barnfield in Essex. Certainly for these first five shows, anyway. But we have plans to take it on the road after that. But you know, the biggest thing, really, the difficulty with anything like this is finding the money to finance it, so you can just get the ball rolling, so to speak. And it was quite a show. The actual subject matter of the show is based on the Ouija board.
Oh. Okay.
And it's based on my experiences on the Ouija board, which were pretty profound. You know, it was a great experience. And so I not only kept many notes of what came through the board, but I also recorded this album with a lot of the words spoken. You know, a lot of spoken words that came from the board, and so the production, really, you know, the plan was to have it as something with actors speaking all these spoken words. I've got a string quartet. There's electric music, acoustic music. There's a cappella singing, a whole range of styles and everything. And yeah. this is the interesting thing. I basically had it there for years, playing it to a few people, and then I suppose the time was right, because this is actually true. Earlier this year, I got on an aeroplane, and I just happened to sit next to somebody who that day had decided to fly to Tenerife, and he happened to be a very wealthy man. And the moment he said to me on the plane, he said, you know, I don't believe that we do the things we do and say what we say and all that just because of this grey matter. And he pointed to his head while he was saying that, you know. Mm. And I said, well, that's interesting, because I've got this stage production that's based a little bit on that theme. And this is honest truth, he immediately turned to me and he said, I'll put money into it.
Well, you were flying. That was literally an angel, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I said to him, I tried to talk him out of it, actually. I said, look, you need to learn a bit more about it before you say that. And he said, and I didn't know if it was for real. And he said, no. He said, I believe in fate. I'll put money into it. Well, we have now formed the Glass Chronicles Company Limited, and he has financed the whole deal. So what can you say about that?
Oh, that's fabulous. And,
it's a great Bardfield, a village that it's quite unlikely, actually, that you'd have a venue like that out in the middle of nowhere, but it's a beautiful, beautiful venue, and it's a very popular place, you know.
What a great turn of events. That's
Yeah, it is. It almost makes you believe, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, the main thing, you know, creativity is always there, you know, and just keep it rolling and good things will happen.
Yes, I think there's a lot to be said for that, you know. There are people I know that won't start anything unless the finance is in place.
Mm.
And for me, what happened here is testimony to the idea that if you believe in something, you should just get it started and everything else will follow.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, easier said than done, but that's what one should strive for, I think.
Exactly. You play the guitar fabulous. You just... I love that album you did, Initial Variations.
I was
listening to that, and it's almost like a whole set of etudes for the guitar, and a wide range of genres you play. Just fabulous quality, and I mean, that takes a lot of work to get to that level of mastery. And is this something, you know, I mean, do you still work on it every day? You still pick up the guitar and you're playing?
Not really. I tend to pick the guitar up if there's a project that I'm working on, or if there is work ahead. You know, I'll always do it in view of something that's happening at some point. Because, you know, I mean, It's this whole thing about inspiration and perspiration, you know.
Mm.
It's easy to pick the guitar up and just play and be inspired for moments and even come up with new ideas. But it's quite hard to actually craft something from start to finish. And so when I pick the guitar up, I tend to do it with that kind of purpose in mind. As far as that album was concerned, first of all, I decided that... I realised I'd never made an album that was just purely instrumentals.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always mix things up, you know, always put in maybe two or three instrumentals on an album.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it would be a good idea just to do one that was only instrumental. And then I was trying to think of a theme, and I've always passionately loved the Enigma variations.
Oh, yeah.
Elgar's Enigma variation. So, and it was the idea that he named some of his pieces after the people he worked with or his family members or whatever. And so I thought, well, I'll do that with my instrumentals. So they're all, every track is initialed. Someone I know, or a relation maybe, or someone who's inspired me perhaps. That was the whole idea behind it.
Interesting, yes. So the first one, CM, who was that?
No, but I never tell anyone who...
Oh, no? Except that one.
No, it's a secret.
Okay.
Some of them are fairly obvious, but I'll just let people just wonder about it.
Good, yeah, you've got to have some of that enigma still, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Listening to a lot of your work, you really seem to like slow ballads.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true, or just what I'm hearing?
I think that was definitely the case years ago. I think now I'd probably gravitate towards that kind of song as much as any other, really. Whatever it is that I do, I just want to try and make it. I try and give it some kind of depth and meaning, you know, whether it be slow or fast or whatever.
The British folk scene is very intertwined, and I know you've had a long association with Ashley Hutchings through this process. That's must have been. Can you tell us something about that? Must have been interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've met Ashley, I think, back in '94 or thereabouts, and it wasn't long before he asked me if I would work with him. In this band that he was putting together called the Ashley Hutchings Dance Band.
Mm.
And I agreed to do that. And in actual fact, the album that we did together, I produced and I co-wrote quite a few of the songs on the album. Not long after that, I became a member of the Albion Band. I don't know how much your listeners know about the folk rock scene back then, you know. But, of course, Ashley was a... founder member of Fairport, and then he left Fairport because he was a founder member of Steel Eye Span,
right?
Before joining the Albion Band. Well, the Albion Band never quite got the success of the other two groups. In fact, I often tell this story though. I say, well, Ashley was in Fairport Convention right at the very beginning, and they did pretty good, but he left the band. And then they got massive hits, you know.
Yeah.
They did very well. And he formed Steel Eye Span. And again, the band were quite popular. And then he moved on, and they got big hits as well, and became very popular. When we were in the Albion Band together, I was forever trying to talk him into leaving. But he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have it.
That was very mercenary of you.
But I was with the Albions for a few years, and we made quite a few albums together and toured a bit. But the highlight for me, really, of that association was the songwriting.
Mm.
And so about 3 years ago, I said to Ashley, you know, I think we should just do an album, just the two of us, because we'd only ever... On the Albion Band records, we'd maybe write a third of the numbers together, or... I don't know, maybe slightly more, but this time I thought we should do a whole album, and so we wrote the album, recorded it here in my studio, and it's called Copper, Russet and Gold.
Oh, lovely.
So that's it, and we're still touring together. In fact, we've got a tour plan for next February.
In Britain, Europe?
Yeah, just in this country, Village Halls, actually, mainly. Village Halls in Derbyshire, Staffordshire and Warwickshire, that's it.
Ah, OK. So, yeah, so now with this move to theatre, do you have other musical works you're working on now?
My main focus really is The Glass Chronicles, you know. I want to see how far I can take this show, and I would be very happy to do a Glass Chronicles 2, because I think this really is it's the closest thing I've got to doing what feels essentially me, if that makes any sense. Mm. I'm writing a book about it as well, so it's... I feel like over the years, what I've been doing is getting closer and closer to doing what feels very, very purposeful for me, and this is a major step in that direction. So I think, you know, I like to move on a lot. I like to feel like I'm moving forward, and this is a big step for me.
Yeah, no, fabulous. Well, you seem a very thoughtful person. You know, it seems like you really go deep into things.
Well, I think that's what got me into music in the first place. The certain music just connected with me. And so I think I've been surprised by how many people just think of music as something that's kind of pleasant, or, you know, this is nice or that's nice or whatever. For me, I'm always searching for that thing that hits the nerve, sends a shiver down me, brings the tears to my eyes, that sort of thing. And so I think playing music has been an attempt, in a way, to express something quite deep within me. And so, consequently, I'd have to say that some of that time, you know, in the 70s when, you know, the record company is saying do this and do this and write this kind of song and that kind of song and you're dressing up in a certain way, it felt so meaningless at times. I didn't know what I was doing. So,
yeah, it was just all on a facade.
It all seemed a bit superficial.
Perhaps you could let my listeners know your website and so they can check out your work and
learn more. Yeah, well, the website is kennicol.com. So that's Nicol, spelt N-I-C-O-L, and not with an H in, as many people spell it. There will be a new site up soon called kennicolmusic.com. But we're just working on that right now.
Well, thank you, Ken. It was really good to get to know you and your background and what makes you such a fine musician.
Well, thanks very much, Arnold. Thanks for the interview.
Oh, a pleasure.
Bye now. Bye.
Bye.